Welcome to The Word from Porter Street, the podcast in which I, Chris Phillips, report on my teaching, research, and whatever else might occur to me to talk about. Well, I thought it had been a long time between the last two podcasts. It was from February to June. Now we are in December of 2012. So this is very much a special edition of the podcast. I apologize for being away so long. There's been plenty happening in the meantime. Among them, I got to have a one-month fellowship at the American Antiquarian Society, which I'll be reporting on in coming weeks. I made it through an entire semester, the fall semester. As some of you listening might know, we've had a number of family medical issues going on. Fortunately, those are on their way to resolving or have resolved, and most excitingly, we've welcomed a new baby to our home, the third of three boys, so we have a very lively household at this point. And there's a lot for me to discuss on the professional front as well. First of all, there are updates to my website. There's a new page for my Easton Library Company project, which I've spoken about a bit before. I presented on that at the Sharp Conference in Dublin this past summer, and that got some excellent feedback, some really good responses from people. I've added links. There are more things coming to that site, so keep an eye out for that. I'm also switching to a nearly weekly schedule for this podcast to try to catch up on things. I have most of January off. We have a Jan term, which is not required at Lafayette, and so I have time to work up some reports on what I've been doing, to work on a few new things, and hopefully talk a little bit about that. The main thing I want to talk about today is a new assignment I developed for my English 212 class. This is the survey course that I teach. It's actually called American Literature 1. And one of the things I love about this course is that it sounds incredibly boring going in. Some students think it sounds like a very safe or very easy course. And the way that I've set this up is actually through an information literacy grant at the college. I have been able to collaborate every time I've taught this course with one of our librarians, Therese Heidenwolf. And what I try to do with the course is rather than march students through the cavalcade of American literature up to, say, the Civil War, I take it up to about 1880, is to get them to think about how they got the American literary history that I'm presenting them. Where did the anthology come from? How did the anthologist decide on these readings? Are there other readings that used to be popular? Are there other readings that could be popular but just aren't? Are there issues in the library as far as how things are organized, how you can access materials that influence the way you experience American literature? So a lot of the assignments are geared to deal with those kinds of questions. One of the things that Therese and I had taught every time that we'd done this, I think we'd done this three times before, is an assignment that we called a reception history. And this involved having students look at essays from different periods that gave critical analyses of some of the readings in our course. And we always felt this was a mixed bag. It was a tricky assignment to teach. There were a lot of different pieces involved in evaluating sources, teaching different search tools. Students tended to either sail with this assignment or really struggle with it. So we decided to try something new. And this was partly prompted by what students had gravitated toward before. We tried to get them to use 20th century sources to look at earlier pieces when we did the reception history, and students kept wanting to know what was actually written when the things came out. What did 19th century readers think of Poe and of Melville and of these other writers that we were looking at? And so the new idea was to develop something that used our electronic as well as print holdings in 19th century periodicals. One of the wonderful things about being at a college that was founded in the 1820s is that we have incredible runs of 19th century periodicals. We have a full run, for instance, of the North American Review, which started in 1815. We have runs of Putnam's Monthly, Harper's Weekly, The Atlantic, The Critic, The Dial, actually both dials. So there are a lot of different things that students can take a look at in our collections, on our shelves, as well as in the American Periodical Series database, which is based on the old microfilm collection. And what Therese and I decided to have students do with this was to search for a particular reading. They choose something from our book list, and they search for it in the database. Then they browse around to see what they find. They might find reprints, they might find reviews, and then what appears around those reviews. Then one of the next things they have to do, they're given a title list of what they might find, but they're also told it's not a complete title list of the periodicals that we physically hold. They then have to figure out how to cross-reference from the APS database to our library catalog and find out if we have a volume on the shelves. And that might be in special collections, that might be in our OpenStax, that might be in our storage area, it might be in a nebulous realm called the Annex. So there are all these different areas that are left for them to explore. And we ask the students to do all of this and then to reflect on their experience, both in terms of how they found themselves thinking through the research, but also what changes when they move from a print form to an electronic form and vice versa. And I have to say, for a sophomore level course, these students wrote some of the most sophisticated work on their research process that I think I've ever read at Lafayette or elsewhere. And I was really impressed with how they engaged with the experience of the print, and many of them actually said that they preferred the print because they found that the browse feature was so much better when you could turn pages rather than clicking between individual PDFs of articles. And they also found that the browse feature helped them to find out things they never would have known about before. For instance, that people might talk about international politics in the same issue of a magazine that includes a Hawthorne story. And I'm definitely going to include this again. And in fact, I'm including the prompt on the website link for this, so you can take a look at this. And I welcome your feedback, any ideas to improve this, any ideas you might have for how you would use this in your own courses, those of you who teach something like this. This is tailored very much specifically to Lafayette's particular library strengths, but I'd be interested to see how this could be adapted to large research libraries as well as even smaller teaching libraries than what we have available at the college. But the poetry that I'd like to turn to for today's reading is a poem that my oldest son has been finding actually something of a joke. He's gotten to the age where he really enjoys certain words that he can kind of turn into swear words. They're not bad by themselves, but you can say them over and over again in a certain tone of voice, and it starts to take on that veneer. And one of the words he likes to say is nothing. And I told him, well, there are poems that talk about nothing. I didn't tell him there was a television show that's about nothing. I decided not to go there. But one of the poems that I thought of is a poem by Edward Taylor. This is usually known simply as the prologue, and it opens a series of poems by Taylor, who is a 17th century Puritan pastor in Westfield, Massachusetts, basically back of beyond for the 17th century in America. And he wrote these in private, never intended them to be public, but this particular set of poems is entitled God's Determinations of His Elect, and it is essentially the drama of Calvinist theology. And Taylor was very unique among Puritan writers in that he showed influence from the metaphysical poets. He was interested in developing very elaborate conceits, wordplay, paradoxes, which do not show up in, say, the works of Anne Bradstreet or Thompson or any of the other poets who are famous among the Puritans. And what I'd like to read here is the beginning that sets out the creation narrative as a prelude, or indeed as a preface, to the drama of Calvinist salvation doctrine. Infinity. When all things it beheld in nothing, and of nothing all did build, upon what base was fixed the lathe wherein he turned this globe and wriggled it so trim? Who blew the bellows of his furnace vast, or held the mold wherein the world was cast? Who laid its cornerstone, or whose command? Where stand the pillars upon which it stands? Who laced and filleted the earth so fine with rivers like green ribbons smaragdine? Who made the seas its selvage, and it locks like a quilt ball within a silver box? Who spread its canopy, or curtains spun? Who in this bowling alley bowled the sun? Who made it always, when it rises, set to go at once both down and up to get? Who the curtain rods made for this tapestry? Who hung the twinkling lanterns in the sky? Who did this? Or who is he? Why, no, it's only might almighty this did do. His hand hath made this noble work, which stands his glorious handiwork, not made by hands. Who spake all things from nothing, and with ease can speak all things to nothing, if he please. Whose little finger at his pleasure can outmeet 10,000 worlds with half a span. Whose might almighty can by half a looks root up the rocks and rock the hills by the roots. Can take this mighty world up in his hand and shake it like a squitchin or a wand. Whose single frown will make the heavens shake like an aspen leaf the wind makes quake. Oh, what a might is this, whose single frown doth shake the world as it would shake it down. Which all from nothing fet, from nothing all, hath all on nothing set, lets nothing fall, gave all to nothing man indeed, whereby through nothing man all might him glorify. In nothing is embossed the brightest gem, more precious than all preciousness in them. But nothing man did throw down all by sin, and darkened that lightsome gem in him, that now his brightest diamond is grown darker by far than any coal-pit stone. Well, the only place we can go from here is up. Thank you for listening to this installment, and until next time, may you find good words and delight in the words that find you.